This is the Financial Sense News Hour. Now, here's the Financial Sense News Team, Jim Poplava and John Loeffler.
Welcome to the big picture for this week, and it almost sounds like a serial. If you remember in our last episode, well, if you remember from last week, we were talking about the central banks and their strategies that they've been trying to use to pump up various economies around the world, the global economy, most of which don't seem to be working. And there was speculation on our part that the next strategy would likely just be the resort to helicopter money, to quote. Was it Alan Greenspan or Ben Bernanke who first used it? I can't remember.
Ben Bernanke. That was his November 2002 speech where he basically said, look, a central bank can always create inflation. And if we can't get it through lower interest rates, we'll just create it and push it into the economy.
Right. So that, of course, creates inflation and problematicals. Now what we're going to do is take the concept of helicopter money and frame it not in the light of the economy, but in terms of what you, the investor, should know about it. How does it affect investments? Now, remember, there are three legs on which most economies stand here. That's the fundamentals, technicals, and politicals. And in case you hadn't flipped on your television this week, we are in the middle of silly season and lots of politicals right now. And the political things that are going on with the Obama administration and anticipation of either a Trump or Clinton administration is definitely affecting the markets. You cannot avoid it. You know, a lot of times, Jim, in the times past on the program, people would say, well, you should stay away from the political stuff and just stay over with the economics. You can't disconnect them. They're intimately connected because of regulation and taxation and laws that affect the economy.
Well, I mean, John, if you take a look at the financial crisis, what got us in the financial crisis was deregulation, leveraging in the economy, and also loose central bank policy. Under Greenspan, he brought the federal funds rate down to 1%, kept them there for a long time, and it gave way to speculation, much as lower interest rates and negative interest rates are today. But here's the thing. When we came out of the financial crisis from 2007 to 2009, the first response of a new president, which is, I think, is going to be the first response of the next president, was a fiscal response. And John, you remember 2009, one of the first acts that Obama did within his first 100 days in office was an $800 billion spending bill. It was a stimulus bill that turned out to be mainly transfer payments, but it got a bump in the economy. And you combine that with the Fed, which announced QE1, which was $1 trillion. So the U.S. economy got a jolt of nearly $2 trillion, almost $1 trillion in stimulus bill. In fact, there was a supplemental spending bill. I forget what the numbers were. I think it was like $300 or $400 billion. So you had almost $1 trillion of fiscal spending and $1 trillion of monetary spending. So that was what brought us out of the recovery. However, one of the reasons why this economic recovery has been so anemic in the post-crisis era, it used to be taxes and inflation. Now it's taxes and regulation. We got all kinds of regulation. There's almost 78,000 pages of regulation that have been added to the Federal Register in the last 7 years alone. We also got, for the first time, some of the most activist monetary policy that we've ever seen. I mean, what have we been talking about on this program for the last 7.5 years? We've been talking about QE1, QE2, QE3, you know, the taper. Will they raise them? Will they not? So we have a very activist-oriented monetary policy today that determines much of what's going on in the market. You take a look at the stock market today, we're hitting record levels. Well, what's driving it? It's not because economic growth is robust. It's not because corporate earnings are going up at double digits a year like they were in 2012 and 2013. It's mainly liquidity injections by central banks. So that's what's driving the market. So what happens in politics, whether it's Congress, whether it's a president, whether it's a central bank, it has an impact on the market. I mean, take a look at the crisis that we went through in 2011 in Europe with the pig country crisis. What brought that crisis, or put it out at least temporarily, was a large injection of quantitative easing by the ECB. Same thing that's going on in Japan today. And so the only central bank around the world right now that seems to be withdrawing from stimulus, although they're still applying it by rolling over their bonds that mature and also keeping the Fed funds rate. Remember, it's taken the Fed almost 3 years to raise interest rates a quarter of a point. So, you know, a Fed funds rate at 0.5%, nobody can argue that we have a tight monetary policy right now. So we've had heavy regulation, which has reduced economic growth. We've had an activist monetary policy, which has had a greater impact on, let's say, places like real estate and also asset prices. Because another reason that you're seeing stocks and stocks, in my opinion, you haven't seen a major correction in the market is because interest rates are negative for a third of sovereign debt around the world. And you're getting nothing in a bank and a money market fund, and even bond yields on treasuries are below 2%. But the third thing that has happened, in addition to this monetary stimulus, we've also seen fiscal stimulus in the sense that the government debt is still going up. It's going up now. It's starting to accelerate after they got rid of the sequester and the budget restraints last November. So by the time Obama leaves office in January, the national debt will be $20 trillion. Obama would have added $10 trillion, more than all his predecessors. Just like when Bush left office in 2009, he doubled the national debt from $5 trillion to $10 trillion. So in this post-crisis world, everything is being driven primarily not by the private sector. To some extent, it is. Social media, you know, Apple, we've seen a lot of innovation, whether it's Tesla, consumer companies like Netflix. You know, we still have a lot of that in this country that's helping. But the main drivers of market returns have been the government in one form or another. It's either deficit spending, regulation, or monetary policy or tax policy.
If you remember, Jim, after the financial crisis, everybody was applauding the Fed. And I think the consensus everyone arrived at was that we had dodged a bullet and they were responsible for getting us through that dodging. We didn't have a 1930s style depression, and that was a real possibility. But ever since then, the job market has been anemic. But at the same time, unemployment numbers have been coming down. Still, you have to look at the impact of taxes and regulation on the whole economy. And you have to zoom it out just a bit and recall that about 90% of the jobs are created by the small businesses in the country. And right at the time we went through that horrible crisis in the 2007-2008 era, Congress dropped Obamacare right on us. And it was a bombshell because nobody knew what was coming. There was a huge fight. And you remember all the acrimony that flew back and forth. Nobody knew what was in the doggone bill. And when you try to expose it, they criticize you. And finally, Nancy Pelosi said, we have to pass it to see what's in it, which tells you how dingy these people can get. But what that did is that just froze even more hiring because businesses of all sizes said, we don't know what this means. We aren't going to hire a single person until we figure this out. And immediately jobs just went right at the moment that we needed to have job hiring going on. So taxes and regs, those are the big crunchers on the economy right now, on jobs especially.
Well, I mean, one of the side effects of Obamacare is if you're a small company and you have workers under 30 hours, you're exempt from covering them under insurance, which is one of the reasons you got the gig economy, or we've seen an increase in part-time work is because people are trying to avoid the onerous impact of these heavy regulations and costs. Another thing too, John, is they went after the financial sector with Dodd-Frank. And one of the things they did is they tried to make it so difficult for these trading departments, for these banks, that actually with liquidity shrunk in the bond market. I mean, people don't realize that we have had convulsions in the bond market, whether it was October of last year on a single day where you saw treasury yields spike, or whether it was, for example, in 2013 when we had the taper tantrum, when the 10-year treasury went from 1.6, it literally almost doubled in a period of 6 months. you know, people think of volatility, they think of the stock market, they don't think of what can happen in the bond market. And what happened in 2011 with sovereign debt in Europe, where you saw Greek bond yields go from 6% all the way to 30%, or when you saw, for example, in 2013 with the taper tantrum, treasury yields double in a six-month period of time. So what they have done is they've restricted banks, and banks have cut back on their bond trading. And what that means is they don't carry as much bonds in inventory. It takes less to move the bond market, and the bond market has become more volatile. It's one of the side effects, as we'll be talking about unintended consequences in part two of the big picture today, is the bond market has become less liquid. At the same time, the debt around the world has expanded tremendously. China's debt is up over 300% since the financial crisis. Global debt is up over twice, and we'll get to some of these stats in just a minute. But what we've given rise to is the rise of the regulatory state. You're seeing it. I don't care if you're looking at the EPA and its ability to shut down and put companies out of business like they're doing to coal in West Virginia, which has become an election year. In a comment that, you know, Hillary Clinton has regretted saying, that she says, we're going to put you out of business. Well, that's what the EPA is doing. You have the IRS going after tax-exempt foundations. You have the Justice Department now prosecuting companies that are against or don't believe in global warming. And that's part of the Democratic platform, by the way, we'll get into later on in this broadcast. So you're seeing the rise of the regulatory state, where you're seeing departments of the government, whether it's the Justice Department, the EPA, take on enormous political power in their own right, even though they're unelected. And so out of this crisis, we've seen the rise of the regulatory state, and its consequences have been, much like we're seeing in Europe, anemic economic growth that has been subpar.
Yeah, but the Fed's really tepid about this whole thing, if you notice, either tepid or timid, or timidly tepid, one or the other. Because every time they talk about raising interest rates, and it was real clear there that Fed Chair Janet Yellen was trying to get some wiggle room in there, some breathing room, so that if we hit another economic bad patch similar to 2007, she'd have some room to stimulate. But every time they talk about doing it, there's no room to do it because the economic numbers are always so bad, and they're always talking about being data dependent.
Well, I mean, part of the problem is economists operate on a theoretical level. They don't operate in a reality level, which is what the private sector does. And that's why when we talk about what's going to happen to interest rates here in the program, we always go with what the futures market is saying versus the Fed. And one of the consequences of high taxes and high regulation has been anemic economic growth. Since 2011 to 2015, GDP growth is averaged 2%. In fact, the best year for economic growth was in 2010. Now, remember, in 2010, we were coming off $1 trillion of fiscal stimulus coming from the government and $1 trillion of monetary stimulus. That was the best we could ever do in this economic recovery. And in 2010, economic growth was 2.5%. And compared to past, in a recovery, we'd come out of a recession, you'd see economic growth rates in the 5, 6, 7% range as the economy responded strongly as the economy first came out of a recession. We have not had that this time.
You know, talk about fantasy land, though, because you always hear the IMF and the Fed and maybe other sources talking about this 3% economic growth. It's like rose-colored glasses. We haven't seen it.
No, we haven't. Like I said, the best economic growth we had was 2.5%, and that was a combination of $2 trillion of fiscal and monetary stimulus. And it's not just the government, John. It is also the Fed itself. I mean, if you looked at 2011, the Fed was talking about economic growth from 3 to 3.6%. Instead, for 2011, economic growth was only 1.6%. And you see this every year when you look at their annual forecast, including 2016. What was the Fed do? In 2016, the Fed was talking this year. If we go back to the December Fed rate hike, they were talking about 3% economic growth in 2016. No way we're going to hit that. We're lucky if we're going to do 2. In 2012, they modified it somewhat. especially remember what we came off of 2011. Think of the Arab Spring, the pig crisis, oil prices over $100 a barrel, the debt ceiling debate, all of that was hitting. So they modified their growth to 2.5 to 2.9%. That's the closest they ever came. We came in at 2.2. Then all of a sudden they get optimistic. In 2013, they said we're going to hit 3%. We did half of that at 1.5%. 2014, they're saying 2.8 to 3.2. Well, we did 2.4. 2015, they were talking about 3%. We did a little over 1.5%. You go back to the beginning of the year, they were talking about 3%. We barely did 1% in the first quarter. We're hitting a little over 2% in the second quarter. We might see a little bit in that 2% range for the third quarter, and probably in the fourth quarter, we'll see if we follow historical patterns. We see the largest economic growth occur in the second and third quarter, and typically the fourth and the first quarter tend to be weak. So, John, we're not getting the kind of results that they're expecting, and yet they keep expounding. And what was it, Einstein, that said repeating the same thing, expecting a different result, is the definition of stupidity or something like that?
Neurotic behavior, I think, is what it was. Yeah, something like that. Doing the same thing over and over again, expecting the same result, is neurotic behavior.
And if you look at the problem with the Fed, and the Fed is even admitting this when they go on Capitol Hill and they go, you guys got to help us out, Congress. You guys got to spend a bunch of money because we can't do it. I mean, if you take a look at the money supply from the year 2000 under Greenspan to recently under Yellen, the money supply has gone from $612 billion to almost $4 trillion. It's up 564%. The CPI is up 35% in that same period of time. Four-year college average tuition has gone up 69%. Average healthcare cost per individual has gone from almost $4,700 to $9,400, most of that from Obamacare. It's up 101%. Medium home prices have gone up 180%. A six-pack of beer is up 108%. Oil prices are up 200%. Spot gold is up nearly 400%. Copper prices up 300%. Corn up 100%. Beef up 100%. The average price of cable television, and we'll talk about this in unintended consequences, up 225%. Government expenditures are up almost 100%. So you have to take a look at this massive amount of debt accumulation. You got to remember, from 2000 to 2008, debt in this country nearly doubled from $28 trillion to $54 trillion. So, you know, and if you take a look at what's going on now, we not only have quantitative easing, we have negative interest rates, and it's a clear-cut message coming from central banks. We'll do whatever we can to create inflation. We'll debase the currency. We'll inflate the currency away. And that's been the consistent message, whether you're talking about the Bank of England, the ECB, the Bank of Japan, or the Fed itself.
Well, obviously, the debt increased significantly under President Bush, but then it doubled under President Obama. And I guess we should point out, in all fairness, Jim, to quote Milton Friedman, the presidents don't really have direct control over this debt. We're just using their administration's periods of time to show that. But the real question is, how do you get rid of this debt? Because there's some classic ways to do it. Number one, you pay it. What a novel concept. Number two...
Really? With government?
Well, it is with ordinary people, okay? All right, anyway. So number two, you renege on it. Or number three, you inflate it away. I mean, that seems to be your only option.
Yeah, I guess there is. I would say five ways to pay it, which is you pay it off. But really, when you think paying it off, it really boils down to four ways that you get rid of debt. One, the favor by governments, you simply inflate it away. That's financial repression. Number two is currency devaluation. Number three, which we've seen in Europe with Greece and other countries, Argentina, lately Puerto Rico, is you default on it. And number four is you grow your way out of it. In other words, you grow the economy, which generates more tax revenues, and you use those increased tax revenues to actually pay off your debt. There's only four ways, John, that you do it. Right now, they have been unable, with current monetary policies, to inflate it away. Currency devaluation is a possibility. I mean, that's what Roosevelt did in 1933, and he got rid of deflation overnight. Third is simply to default, which you'd never see in a reserve currency, and four is to grow your way out of it. You can't increase taxes and create a regulatory state and grow your way out of it. It's two main things that are hindering the effectiveness of monetary policy is taxes and regulation. So, John, we are now on to what the subject is of this first big picture is helicopter money. It's basically if we can't get people to borrow, if we can't get money into the economy, we're really entering into the final end game here now, which is going to be a massive fiscal stimulus where you use government policy in one form or another, either in transfer payments or tax cuts, to inject money into the economy. And we're going to talk about the Democratic platform and the Republican platform because you have two different views of how you're going to get money into the economy. The result of all of this helicopter money is you're going to see rising debt levels and rising deficits. The U.S. deficit is already bottomed. This year, it's going to go from last year somewhere closer to 400. This year, it'll be closer to 600 billion because they got rid of the sequester in the last year's budget deal. And then simply, as the deficits grow and get bigger and government spends more money, the Fed will simply monetize it. And that's how you're going to get money into the economy.
And that's why I would think right now what we need to do is turn and look at what the platforms are saying, both from the Republican and Democratic Party, and urge people to take them seriously. Because if you go back to what President Obama was promising to do during the campaign back in 2008, he was promising to raise taxes, to introduce this health care plan, and to raise entitlements. And that's precisely what he did.
And that's why, John, as we said last week, one of the key things that we're going to be looking for, you already heard hints from various government officials. I don't care if it's people like Lawrence Summers, who's at Harvard, who was a former Treasury Secretary. If you're listening to various central bankers are talking about the same thing. And it's not just here. They're talking about it in Europe. They're talking about it in Japan. So that's why you have to take a look at these different platforms of both parties, because the people that are running for office are saying, if you elect me, and supposedly if you elect them, it's because you favor what they're going to do economically, you need to pay a lot of attention to that. And what we're looking for is, okay, we know helicopter money is coming. What kind of helicopter money? Is it going to be wealth redistribution, which is one form, or is it going to be tax cuts, which is another form? So we have two different approaches in this election. And if you want to follow along with what we're going to be talking about here, just simply Google the Republican platform. It's about 51 pages long. You can download it. And basically, Donald Trump and the Republican Party is saying, if we're elected, these are the things that we want to do, and these are the things that we stand for. Now, the one difference is if you Google, let's say, the Democratic platform, you're going to see it's, what is this thing? It's about 40 pages. It says draft. And the reason it says draft on it is this platform still needs to be voted upon by the committee at next week's Democratic convention. So it's still in a formative stage. All these provisions have to be voted on before it becomes the official platform. But we do have both the Democratic platform and the Republican platform, and we need to talk about them because there are two different approaches of how they intend to get money into the economy via some form of a helicopter drop.
All right. Well, obviously, by the end of this week, Republicans were finished. They have adopted their platform. So let's start with that one and see what they're proposing.
Okay. There are a number of things they're proposing. One would be corporate tax reform. And everybody has been railing against, including Donald Trump, about companies leaving the U.S. and going offshore, although much of that is stopped today because globalization, there's an anti-globalization movement right now. And if you built a factory overseas, there's not too many major companies that are building any new factories. But they're basically saying, look, we don't want you leaving here. And we understand why you're leaving here, because the U.S. has the highest corporate income tax rates in the world. So one would be tax reform. And that would be, they would get rid of a lot of these special tax write-offs and preferences that come in through lobbyists. You know, you contribute to a senator or a congressman to their campaign, and then they reward you by creating special tax incentives. That's the way Washington works today. And that applies to both sides of the aisle, Democrats and Republicans. So they're saying, we want to reform corporate taxes. and create an incentive to bring back that $2.5 trillion of corporate cash that is stashed overseas, that as long as it's over there, they don't have to pay taxes on it in the U.S. If they bring it back to the U.S., they have to pay 35% federal taxes plus any kind of state tax if they're domiciled in a state that has an income tax. So there would be a lowering of taxes for corporations. They say, we know why you're leaving. We're going to make it competitive for you to bring that money back here under the condition you will use it to invest in the U.S. economy. The second thing they want to do is lower taxes for all taxpayers, small businesses, large businesses, rich people, poor people, middle class. In other words, they're saying, we're going to lower taxes. Primarily, the lowest tax rates will come to middle class and the poor. The first issue on the Republican platform is tax reform. The second issue is infrastructure spending, and this is a common thread between all of them. The third is cutting government waste. The fourth, in the draft of the Democratic platform, Bernie Sanders' thing on free trade and the Trans-Pacific Trade Pact was not in there, but in the Republican platform, there is something about protectionism on international trade. And then there's about 10 pages on law and order and national defense, implying heavy spending on defense. Our nuclear triad is in disrepair. Our troop strength is being brought down. By the time Obama leaves office, he'll reduce troop strength. Another 150,000 troops will be down below a level we were before World War II. So they're talking about modernizing defense. They're talking about refurbishing our nuclear triad. They're talking about going ahead with weapon systems, modernizing weapon systems, whether it's our new destroyer, our new submarine, and various things to make our military the top in the world. So there's a heavy emphasis on defense spending. So if you boil down Republican platform, they're saying we're going to get money into the economy. And one of the ways we're going to do that is through tax cuts. We're going to cut taxes on working families. We're going to cut taxes for everybody across the board. We're going to reform corporate taxes and get us away from having the highest corporate tax rates under the condition if that money comes back to the United States, it'll be taxed at a lower rate under the condition it'll be invested in the U.S. economy. So one way they want to inject money into the economy is through tax cuts. Secondly, government will go after infrastructure spending because we need to. Our roads, bridges, dams, airports are becoming second rate. And then third is they would increase defense spending. So those, I would say, if you were to boil down the Republican platform, you could boil it down to that.
Okay, then we've done Republicans. Democrats, they're up next week with their convention, and the proposals are still in draft form. They haven't been officially adopted by the committee there, but at least what is it in draft form? Because that is what they're publishing on their site.
Well, you know, as the Washington Post and the New York Times put it, it is the most progressive or most radical Democratic platform in the history of the party. I mean, it pretty much reads like a socialist manifesto. And once again, you're seeing the difference here between the two parties. One party, as we just went through, the Republicans, want to use the private sector economy. In other words, they want to cut taxes, get that money into the economy, get companies and individuals to make free market decisions and invest in the economy. The Democrats, on the other hand, say, you know what? We can do things better than the private sector. We're going to use government to inject that money. And one of the ways they're going to do that is through what we call redistribution. Redistribution is basically taking from one individual and giving it to somebody else. So a number of things on the platform, raising the minimum wage to $15 an hour. There would be a new employer mandate, which would require employers to pay for paid leave. I don't know, you want to take a sabbatical or caregiving for somebody that's ill in the family. Social Security, they want to say strengthen Social Security and expand it by increasing taxes on individuals making $200,000 to $250,000. A common thread here is they want to expand infrastructure spending. Remember, that was the original objective of the Obama stimulus. Unfortunately, they didn't have any stimulus-ready projects. They also want to punish Wall Street, and this one makes no sense. And, you know, everybody's railing against Wall Street, those evil bankers. But what they want to do is impose a tax on every security transaction. So if you buy a stock or a bond or who knows, a mutual fund, it's not quite clear how this would work. You would pay a tax of 0.3% to 0.5%. Folks, that isn't a tax on Wall Street. That's a tax on you, the investor. Wall Street's not going to pay that tax. They'll simply pass that tax on you, the investor. They also want to do a surtax on millionaires and billionaires. They want to raise the estate tax rate, which is currently 40%. They also want to lower the current estate tax exemption that is free from estate taxes. Currently, it's $5,450,000. They want to get it back down closer to the $1 million level. They also want to start a carbon tax on energy. And this is a really a kind of global warming climate change agenda. And what is really scary here, there's a whole provision called environmental justice, where the Justice Department and government agencies would go after individuals and companies that are opposed to climate change. And the Justice Department is considering filing suits, for example, against Exxon. There would also be free education if you make under $125,000. And then there would also go after private schools and charter schools. They're basically saying government schools are run better. So this is very much a socialist type approach to stimulus. Rather than using the private economy, the government says, we know how to run the economy better. We would simply take money from one group to pay for it and give it to the other group to spend it. So you have two complete different approaches on how to stimulate the economy here, John, between both the Republicans and the Democrats. One relies on the private sector. The other one believes the government sector is the answer to really get this economy working.
You know, you have to recognize these are two completely different approaches to trying to get things going even better to get the economy back on its feet. We do know so far the bigger government approach hasn't worked so far, and we don't know who's going to be president. But if you look at both parties, both platforms, both of them involve spending money, and then zooming out to realize what Professor Larry Kotlikoff has been saying is, but we're already seriously broke. How do you intend to do this? And as you mentioned before, there are only a limited number of ways for government to get money. And so in this environment, given the fact that you have two different approaches, there's an uncertainty that we don't know what they're going to be. So for the investor, how do you work in this environment and maybe anticipate both sides or position yourself that it doesn't make any difference who wins?
One common thread between the Democrat platform and the Republican platform is infrastructure. So let's put it this way. Both sides are going to be spending money and the Fed is going to monetize it. So that is going to be good for risk off investments. We will go from the risk off trade where everybody's sort of piling in investments. It's amazing. Last year we had the mnemonic FANG. It was Facebook, Apple, Netflix, and Google. This year we had STUB, which is consumer staples, telecoms, utilities, and bonds. Well, under either platform, government's going to spend money, and it's going to be massive amounts of money. The deficits will go back to $1 trillion a year, and the Fed is simply going to monetize it. So that is going to be good for the risk on trade. And so there will be an emphasis on infrastructure. So whether the Democrats win or the Republicans win, there's going to be an emphasis there on trying to do something about the country's infrastructure. Under a Democratic platform, it would be more wealth redistribution. The problem with wealth distribution, just like the economic stimulus from 2009, once you give somebody money to spend, once they're done spending it, you got to keep giving them money. So we would probably have larger and larger deficits. And I think that would bring back the inflation trade under either Republicans and Democrats, I think more so with Democrats. And you would have the inflation trade, which would actually be good for tangible assets like commodities, energy. And under the Democrats, they're going to emphasize, they're going to go after companies and prosecute them if you're against climate change. So anything that has to do with green energy would probably do well. I don't care if it's solar, if it's wind. So that would be an emphasis placed there. And also, I think infrastructure under the Republicans, I think industrials and definitely defense. I mean, almost 20% of the Republican platform was based on rebuilding our national defense, given all the threats on the day that we're doing this. John, have you ever noticed? It's like last Friday, we had a military coup in Turkey, and this Friday, We had a terrorist attack in Germany where 8 dead so far in a mall shooting. It's almost like the terrorist attacks are coming almost every single week now, someplace in the world. If they're not occurring here, they're occurring elsewhere in the world. So there would be a heavy emphasis on defense spending under the Republicans versus, let's say, the Democrats. So, you know, at this point, John, the Democratic platform is yet to be adopted. So we'll have to wait to see what happens at the convention next week. And once again, we'll have to see how this turns out on the polls.
And something we should note, by the way, is that the polls, very much like in the elections of 1994, the polls have been off quite a bit this year. They were off about the Brexit. They've been off about Trump's possibility of getting as far as he has. The polls aren't necessarily an indicator, because apparently when things get down to the wire, people change their minds from what the polling data said earlier.
Yeah. So, I mean, the key thing that you need to walk away from here, if you're an investor, is it doesn't matter whether the Democrats get in or the Republicans get in, they're going to have an impact on the market, spending in one form or another. We know the helicopter drops are coming. It's just a matter of what kind of helicopters they're going to use to make those drops. Your job as an investor is to interpret that in its impact on the markets, so to make sure that you protect yourself and that you're invested in the right areas. The important thing to remember now is most of our markets today are not being driven by what we call fundamental economic factors, or, you know, things like price earnings ratios, dividend yields. They're being driven by monetary policy right now and government policy, whether it's taxes and regulation, or it's going to be the philosophy about what either party proposes to do once they assume office next January 20th. And so that's one of the things we wanted to do this week, was look at these platforms and say, all right, is there a confirmation about helicopter money coming? And John, there's no place really, unlike, I would say, the election of 2010 or 2012, when everybody was talking about these just trillions of dollars of debt that the government was amassing. We had the sequester, we had budget limitations. Everybody was talking about bringing those trillion-dollar deficits under control. There's nowhere any concern about what's going to happen to the deficits. There's an agreement in both parties. The government needs to do more and spend more. So it's just a matter of philosophy in terms of how that helicopter money gets injected in the economy. Your job as an investor to figure that out and invest appropriately.
You're listening to the Financial Sense News Hour at financialsense.com.
In case you didn't know it, the Financial Sense News Hour is more than just our weekend show. We also have a weekday program featuring key economic experts, which is only available to our premium members. Here's part of one of the interviews from this last week.
With the strongest quarterly performance we've seen in 30 years, gold is back. So write the authors of the definitive and widely read In Gold We Trust report, with Incrementum's fund manager, Ron Stolferle, joining us today to tell us all about what's going on with gold, monetary policy, his outlook for the global economy, and much, much more. And I should note, we last spoke to Ron about his book, The Austrian School for Investors, which I'll link out to this interview in addition to the In Gold We Trust report, which is available to the public. Ron, I want to ask you, I think, probably the most important question for our audience, and that is, what is your outlook for gold now that we've seen it break free from this downtrend that's really been in place, I would say, since the 2011 peak? Where do you think gold is heading?
One main takeaway of the report is that gold is back in a bull market. And talking to institutional clients the last few months, everybody missed this huge move in the first quarter. As you've said, gold had the strongest quarter in more than 3 decades. But nobody was really participating, because when we think back, January 2016, everybody was bearish gold. So I'm showing this cycle of investor sentiment applied to the gold price. And we can tell that at the bottom, we have seen it was something between depression and desperation and selling panic. And so I think that we are on the verge of going to the second phase, which is the public participation phase, when all the market analysts upgrade their price targets for gold, when everybody is becoming a bit more upbeat regarding mining stocks, people become concerned regarding inflation and so on. I think we're at the beginning of this phase. And, you know, my long-term target has always been $2,300, which is the inflation-adjusted all-time high. Perhaps we'll have to raise our price target. At the moment, it still seems very, very high. But remember, back in 2011, all the main Wall Street banks, they had price targets for gold between 2,500 and 3,000 or even more. So I think it's still, I would say, kind of contrarian to be very, very positive regarding gold. And I think we're only at the beginning of this party.
I don't know if you've noticed it or not, but, you know, we are in an election year. This may not have
occurred. I had no idea. Is that what's going on?
Yeah, that's what it is. Haven't you been watching? I mean,
you turn on TV, you can't see anything but the conventions.
Well, not only that, but we refer to it here on the program as silly season, because first of all, they'll launch all sorts of attacks upon each other. Only when one of the candidates gets proposed as being the candidate of the party, they hug and make up and say all is forgiven. So you have to really scratch your head about all of this. But anyway, it's also silly season because they're making literally an avalanche of promises that government is going to make X, Y, Z things better by taking government action or making government spending. And I was listening to Professor Larry Kotlikoff recently, in which he's describing the fact that the government gazauta is a lot more than its gazenta. And we're running a horrible deficit when you really analyze the amount of money being spent versus what we're taking in. The other problem is every time government tries to jump into the fray and do something that especially the private sector could probably do a lot better, quite often they make things a lot worse due to the law of unintended consequences, because every time a law is made, people try to adjust for the law to interpret it or enact it in their own best interest. And sometimes that's in the interest of avoiding the law legally. And that's what we call the law of unintended consequences. It makes things worse. So I'm not sure what some of these consequences are, but I have a feeling you're going to tell us.
Well, let's begin with the one that we've been talking about for probably the last 7 or 8 years, which are low interest rates and negative interest rates. Now, understand when we came out of the financial crisis, when there were heavy debt burdens, the banks were basically bankrupt due to bad loans, that the Fed brought down interest rates to make the onus of massive amounts of debt more palatable. And it worked. They recapitalized the banks. And the housing market eventually recovered. The economy also recovered. So you could say, okay, this was very helpful. This was good. I mean, we needed those lower interest rates to help turn this thing around. But let's now talk about the unintended consequences. One of them, which is wonderful it is today to be a borrower, and the main borrower in the marketplace is the government. So government borrowing costs have never been this low. The U.S. government today pays less in interest expense each year, even though it has $9 trillion more in debt today than where it was 7 years ago. So for borrowers, these are great. But the unintended consequences are look what it's done to savers. Think of people that saved all their life. They put money in the bank. They had their money on deposit in CDs, safe investments like treasuries or treasury bills. They are getting absolutely nothing. Money today is becoming meaningless. We've done shows on this program where we show that, you know, $1 million today, if you invested it in a CD, a money market fund, or let's say a 10-year treasury note, gets you next to nothing. You can't live on what your income would produce off $1 million, which just goes to show you $1 million doesn't buy what it used to be. There's another consequence of low interest rates, and that's hurting the banking sector. Because banks make money, and one of the reasons why banks were doing well at the beginning of the year, I'm talking about bank stocks versus where bank stocks have been now, is the markets were anticipating that the Fed would be raising interest rates, so long-term rates would be going up. Bankers make the money on the spread. That's how they make a profit. They pay you, 0.5% on your CD. They turn around and charge you 3.5% or 4% to borrow money on a mortgage, to buy a home, or to buy a car. Instead of interest rates going up, interest rates got down to all-time record levels. So bank profit margins have been squeezed as a result, which is the Fed is hoping that because the interest rates are so low, the banks would lend. But the margins for banks aren't as wide, and they're reluctant because you got to remember, a bank needs those wide profit margins, not only for profit, but they also have to put aside money in reserve to account for bad loans. And they know as you get to the end of a business cycle, some of the loans they're going to make aren't going to turn out. And they're going to have reserves to cover those bad loans against as they write them off, as they lose money on those loans. Well, they don't have as much in reserves when they're not making as much profit. So the lower interest rates, John, have harmed bank profits.
Well, you know, it's interesting because the stock market's really crazy. I mean, there seems to be a detachment from reality. It's not the economy that's driving the stock market. It certainly isn't corporate profits. So what is driving it is rather crazy, like I said.
Well, it's low interest rates, and the liquidity that's being injected into the financial system is really distorting the stock market. And you're right. As we talked with our technician, Gary Dorsch, in the first hour, the stock market is at record levels, and it looks like it's going to go even higher. Can you argue, well, gee, it's corporate profits that are driving it? No. Corporate profits will be down for the fifth consecutive quarter as a result of second quarter profits. And that trend is likely to continue going forward. So it's not corporate profits. It certainly isn't rising revenues at many companies as the economy has slowed down. And it certainly isn't robust economic growth. We're barely going to make 2% economic growth this year. But when you drive interest rates down to the lowest levels we've seen in human history, where are you going to put your money? You can actually make higher returns in the stock market. I was just reading a bond report by Bloomberg, and there are record amounts of money going into junk bonds at a time when the spread between junk bonds and treasuries is narrowed, meaning the safety margin to be in junk bonds is not as great as it used to be, and at a time that defaults on junk bonds are actually increasing. So you're distorting the financial markets, the fundamentals that you would normally look at in a stock market. Okay, where are we in the economy? Is the economy accelerating, picking up? What's going on with the PMIs? What's happening with corporate profits? Are they increasing, decreasing? I mean, the fundamentals that normally drive the market over the longer term are being distorted because people are just simply trying to find a safe place to put their money. And so our financial markets are being distorted. I don't care if you look at the bond market, which is distorted by central bank intervention and quantitative easing, the stock market, which is being distorted by all this money and liquidity chasing and trying to find a place to land and earning a decent return, because you can't keep your money on the sidelines forever. I mean, people have had their money in cash for, 8 years, and they're making nothing. So it's distorting the stock market. And then the final distortion or the unintended consequence of these low interest rates are the problems that state, municipal, and corporate pension funds are running. I mean, CalPERS just released their results for 2015. The rate of return on the largest pension fund in the country was less than 0.7%. Now, the problem is CalPERS is using assumptions of 7-8% return to fund its retirement benefits. So you're looking around the country. You're seeing municipalities get into major fiscal problems. States get into major fiscal problems because they are not earning enough money on the returns of their money invested to fund those retirement benefits they're promising teachers, state and city employees. And that's also happening at the corporate level and individual level. It's the same thing that individuals that are putting money in 401k plans that, you know, and especially with the boomers that were hoping to retire. I mean, what a boomer can earn today on their investment portfolio compared to what they could earn, let's say, 15 years ago was night and day. You could have made 7-8% back in the year 2000. Today, if you want to go into, let's say, a safe investment, you're looking at 1-2% best. So you have to go out further on the risk curve. But John, this is really creating a fiscal crisis with the nation, state, and municipality and their pension funds. Part of the problems with Detroit and some of the other areas, and even some of the cities that went bankrupt during the financial crisis in California, most of those problems stem from unfunded pension liabilities.
You know, I remember you did an interview recently with Larry Kotlikoff. As a matter of fact, I was listening to parts of it before we started doing the show here, and he pointed out that the unfunded liability for both Medicare and Social Security combined is 100, this is a breathtaking, hold your breath, $199 trillion. And also, remember last year the Congress began making changes in Social Security, the media didn't even flinch. This is what I call the great reneging has begun. But the Social Security trustees have reported that in 1 year, in their latest report, Social Security liabilities went up $6 trillion. But now, zoom out, zoom into the political campaign. Donald Trump doesn't want to touch entitlements, but we're still drowning in that. But Mrs. Clinton is promising to widen them. This is delusional. It's nothing short of delusional.
Now, and once again, it's the unintended consequences. Yes, low interest rates help to bring us out of a recession and a severe financial crisis, but they've remained low for far too long, John, which is the dilemma the Fed is facing now. But the unintended consequences of those low interest rates, it's harmed savers, it's harmed bank profits, it's distorted the financial markets, it's harming pension funds and insurance companies that rely on a decent rate of return to fund their retirement benefits. So that's why not only Dr. Robert Merton from Harvard to Lawrence Kotlikoff have talked about the next crisis in America. Is it going to be a retirement crisis? Because how are you going to pay for Medicare when the Social Security Disability Fund was bankrupt? That's why they had to do that emergency change to Social Security last year and switch money from Social Security over to the Disability Fund to keep it afloat until after the election. So these are just one example of unintended consequences.
What are a couple others that are on the list?
One that I think is egregious is what I call government-induced inflation, and it really isn't measured properly in the CPI. And that's what has happened to basic living expenses. You know, they don't call them taxes, they call them fees. But folks, take a look at your utility bill, your phone bill, your cable bill, and your electric bill, and take a look at all the government fees that are added to your bill. They just tack them on and increase them. I know here in California, California is going through a drought. And so they urge the citizens of California to consume less water, be more circumspect on your landscaping. Well, we did that. The result was we used less water. Well, to the water companies, it meant that they took in less revenue. So to counteract that, they raised the cost of water. So a lot of things that are added on to your basic living expenses, you know, your utilities, phone, cable, and electric have a lot of government embedded inflation in it. You still have to pay it. You don't have a choice. They raise the fees or tack on those fees. It's done by the legislature. You didn't vote for it. They did. There's also an increasing cost of compliance today for companies with all the bureaucratic red tape from OSHA to everything. I don't know what your office looks like, John, but in our lunchroom, our walls are literally covered with OSHA posters. I mean, we're going to have to start wallpapering the office. They keep putting out more and more. One of my clients suggested that we just have a TV in the lunchroom and just have it scroll down with all the red tape and regulations. Regulations in compliance cost a lot of money. It increases the cost for you and me on anything we purchase. If a business has to spend more on compliance, they're going to pass that cost on to you and me as consumers. Another area, and this was done, the Wall Street Journal did a great article on this week, is the cost of permitting and fees in terms of what it's adding to the cost of housing. Here in California, it almost takes almost a year to get through a permit. And all of the fees that are tacked on can add up to almost 5 to 10% of the cost. And it's not just the fees that you pay as a homeowner. It's also the fees that your builder or developer is going to have to pay on housing. You take a look at minimum wage. When the government increases the minimum wage from $10 to $15, you know, and I find this ironic because what it'll do is it'll increase wage inflation. And what will happen is the Fed will respond and say, they monitor wage inflation. When wage inflation starts to increase, guess what the Fed's going to do to counteract the wage inflation? They're going to start raising interest rates and take us into a recession, which creates unemployment. You take a look at healthcare cost and what is happening there. You know, next year, if depending on your income, you're going to see a 23% increase in your Medicare premium payments and also a 23% increase in your deductibles. For most individuals in the private sector, they're going to see double-digit returns on their medical insurance next year as the full cost of Obamacare is finally put into place after the presidential election. And if you take a look at what's happened to healthcare costs, contrary to, you know, it was going to save the average family $2,500, that's all balderdash. It's hyperbole. What has happened is healthcare costs have been going up at high single digits. So this is government-induced inflation, John, that does not get added in to the consumer price index. And one reason middle-class families are being squeezed is all these little fees on their utility bill, their phone bill, their cable bill, their utilities, their housing, healthcare costs. All of that is getting added up and doesn't get measured properly. You still have to pay them. What are you going to do? You don't have a choice. And it's raising the cost of living.
Well, we have to talk about taxation, too. That actually figures into retirement, by the way, because if taxes keep going crazy, retirees are going to have trouble. But if we just look at the Democratic platform right now, I have a list of 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, over 10 new taxes they're proposing, something like that.
Oh, yeah. And there are unintended consequences. Okay, one of the issues that has been made in this campaign by both parties, Donald Trump talking about companies moving their businesses offshore, or the Democrats talking about penalizing companies and not paying their fair share. One of the reasons they're doing it is the U.S. as a country has the highest corporate tax rate in the world at 35%. And corporations have a fiduciary obligation to their shareholders to say, hey, we're going to minimize it. And if they try to impose higher taxes or some kind of tariff on companies that move offshore, what you're going to see is you're just going to see them move out of the country. And what that'll do is it will displace a lot more jobs. And that's something that happens. And John, you see it all the time with individuals that are moving from high cost of living, high welfare states with high taxation to lower states where the cost of living is much, much lower, in states that have no income tax or the tax rates are much lower. I mean, I just take a look at what's happening to California. I forget how many taxpayers that we have lost out of this state versus the new people coming in not paying taxes. And they're moving to places where the cost of living is cheaper, whether it's housing, medical care, or anything else, or even college expenses. They're moving to places like Nevada, where the cost of living is cheaper. There's no state income tax. They're moving to states like Arizona, where the average tax rate is only 2.5%. Property taxes are cheaper. Income taxes are cheaper. The cost of living, electricity is cheaper, or states like Texas. So you're seeing tax inversions not only just from corporations, but you're also seeing tax inversions by individuals that are saying, you know what, I'm tired. I mean, California has a high tax rate of 13.3%. You're talking about federal taxes of 44%, and depending on who wins the election, if Hillary Clinton wins, you could see federal taxes go up to close to 60% with surtaxes. And, you know, you add that to a state of California, take 60%, add 13% state income taxes, you're talking about the government taking almost 75% of what you make. You keep one quarter what you make and the government gets 75%. Do you really think that that is going to bolster the economy? A good example is what happened in Japan, where they came in with Abenomics and they came in with this monetary stimulus to get the economy going. But then they turn around and slap a sales tax and it sent the economy in recession. Take a look at what happened to France's economy when they raised income taxes to 75%. People that make money have a means to not only shelter that income or basically stop investing. So there are consequences to high taxes. And the problem is, in academic circles and also in political circles, they do something called static accounting. And let me give you an example of what I mean by that. Let's say, for simplification, that the government takes in $1 million a year in tax revenues. And let's say the tax rate is 50%. We'll just make this mathematically easy. So if the government, in their thinking, raises tax rates to, let's say, 60% Instead of $1 million worth of revenues, they're going to have $1.1 million of revenues. They'll have $100,000 more in revenues. What they don't take into effect is the evasive action that people take to reduce those taxes, whether they go into tax-free bonds, whether they go into tax-deferred investments, whether they go into tax-sheltered investments, or like corporations, they just simply move offshore, because by moving offshore, you can control what you pay in taxes. That's why there's almost $2.5 trillion of untaxed profits overseas, because corporations don't want to bring them back, because why would they want to pay 35% in federal taxes? God knows whatever state taxes they would have, like in California, which are 13%. So high taxation can have an impact. The problem is they use static accounting. Same way, if they go through a tax cut, they don't look at what it does to stimulate the economy by lowering taxes. I mean, when you take a look at what governments are trying to do overseas to stimulate their economy, they're lowering taxes. They're not raising them. Well, one party's talking about raising taxes here. So the unintended consequences are the economic effects that it has when taxes are raised. People will try to take evasive action to try to shelter their income or shelter paying taxes because they don't want to pay it.
Okay, Jim, any other examples you can think of?
Yeah, a good example is minimum wage. State of California just raised its minimum wage. We were one of the first, from $10 to $15. They're going to phase it in over a couple of years. And the idea is, well, everybody should have a living wage. The problem is, John, this is distorted economic thinking. Anybody that works at McDonald's or a fast food restaurant, these are starter jobs. I don't know of anybody, John, that, you know, graduates from high school and instead of going to college, say, you know what, I aspire to be a French fry maker at McDonald's. They're starter jobs. They're for college students, part-time students, and they're kept that way for a reason. And what is going to happen is they raise the minimum wage to $15. You've already seen it from restaurants, and you're seeing it already. They're replacing workers with automation. So you're seeing a lot of restaurants go to mobile apps. They're going to kiosks, which is going to replace people on the front counter. McDonald's has gone to a machine that makes French fries. You're going to see that with burger joints. So you're going to see people that are going to be replaced by machines, because if you're a business owner, your largest expense, let's just say you own a McDonald's franchise, your largest expense is labor. If they raise the cost of your labor 50%, what does that mean as a business owner? You're going to have to raise the cost of the food that you sell your customers to accommodate the cost of the increased labor. And the higher that cost goes up, the less people are likely to eat at your restaurant because it becomes more expensive. People only have so much money to spend. If you have to raise the cost of your goods by 50%, what do you think that's going to do to your business? So what businesses are doing is they're automating. We saw this in manufacturing. Today, factories, the U.S. is making more goods, manufactured goods, with fewer workers, because instead of Larry, Moe, and Curly on the assembly line putting bumpers on, you're having a $25 million robot doing the assembly. So it takes fewer workers to assemble or make something because of automation, because it brings down the cost of labor and raises productivity. So one of the consequences of minimum wages is, number one, it's going to create more unemployment. You watch what happens to youth unemployment, and you'll start seeing it. I mean, when you have a fast food restaurant saying, you know what, we're getting rid of workers, we're going to go to a kiosk system, we're going to machines to make French fries and burgers, that means those jobs are gone forever. They're gone. They're not coming back. So you're going to have alternative means of coping with that high cost. The other thing that happens, and this is like two government forces working against each other, as the cost of labor begins to go up, it creates labor inflation. What does the Fed talk about when it talks about whether it's going to raise or lower? They're monitoring inflation. They're monitoring wage inflation. Well, what happens when you raise the minimum wage? It indexes union contracts, wages. It all starts to go up. You get labor inflation. What's going to be the Fed's response? They're going to start raising interest rates to a point where they choke off economic growth, create a recession, create unemployment, and we actually lose more jobs. So there are a lot of unintended consequences that you know, it sounds great. Gee, I want everybody to, you know, it's who wouldn't want to make more money? If you're making 10 bucks an hour, wouldn't you want to make 15 bucks an hour? But there are consequences. The thing you got to ask is, will that job be there at $15 an hour versus $10 an hour? Because the business owner is going to have to take some kind of action to maintain and keep his cost and margins where they are, or otherwise, we're going to have a major escalation in food prices, which is inflationary. And what happens when inflation goes up? You guessed it. The Fed will be raising interest rates to combat inflation. So here is just one example that a lot of these politicians, as well-meaning as they may be, do not think of the unintended consequences. I mean, has the Fed really thought of what they've done to distort the financial markets? Have they really thought of the impact on pension funds, union pensions, private pensions of low interest rates and unfunded pension liabilities? Has the government really thought about what is happening to the middle class with all these fees and taxes that get added on? And by the way, folks, there isn't enough rich people to pay for everything the government wants to give you. I'm sorry, but the middle class and the poor are going to have to pay taxes. And just as in 2018, when everybody's Medicare expenses are going to go up versus just say only 30% who will see their Medicare premiums go up 23%, there are unintended consequences. And unfortunately, John, these politicians, most of them have never worked in the private sector. They've never had to write a paycheck or cover a paycheck. And a lot of them come from academic circles as their advisors. They haven't worked in the real economy. So all this stuff is theoretical. It sounds really great. It makes for great sound bites on television. It's a good thumping speech of a politician at a convention, but nobody thinks and follows through. I mean, you really think that you can widen Medicare benefits, widen Social Security benefits, and give people free college when the unfunded liabilities right now of Social Security went up $6 trillion in 1 year alone, and the total unfunded liabilities are $199 trillion? The only way we're going to pay for that is default or to inflate it away. And that's some of the unintended consequences, as we covered, of government-induced inflation. When they mark up something, cause a business to pay more for compliance and regulations, dealing with red tape, all of that goes into the cost of something. And I really blame the media, John, for doing such a poor job deliberately. I mean, there's really a cover-up of all these unintended consequences. I mean, if I can read this in the Wall Street Journal or the Financial Times or read this on the internet, you don't think these journalists could? I mean, why aren't these questions being asked of politicians of how are you going to pay for all that? You know, the simple answer, well, let's just make rich people pay for it. Well, folks, you know, eventually you run out of other people's money, as Margaret Thatcher said. And even if you took all the money of all the billionaires, all the millionaires, and all the people making over $100,000, you would simply run the government for 1 year. So the only way that all of this is going to be paid for, and there was the study on the trustees report, basically with entitlements. And there was a study analyzing both the Democratic platform and the Republican platform. By the year, John, by the time I think we get, I'm trying to think of the year, it's 2025, 100% of government revenues will go to entitlements and interest on the debt, meaning there will be no money left to run the military, to run the office of government, whether it's the Justice Department, the Department of Education, or Congress. There'll be no money left. It'll have to be 100% debt financed. And this is something that nobody is simply asking these politicians, what are the unintended consequences of the decisions that they make?
You know, Jim, I'm wondering if we aren't looking at a number of different trends here. One, we know if you watch the people testifying before Congress, there's a lot of economic illiteracy among congressional members. Let's face that. Okay, that's numero uno. The next question you could say, do these people know what they're doing or not? If we look at Hillary Clinton or Donald Trump, who can tell? You know, but what they are doing is they're compelled to do it because that's what you have to do to get elected. And then the third question is, can they ever do anything else? But I mean, if you look at the size of Social Security and Medicare and the deficits right now, is it even dealable, or are we just inevitably committed to a train wreck? I think those are the questions that have to be asked.
Yeah, and the IMF and several other organizations are taking a look at these entitlement costs, the aging population, and the rising debt levels. I mean, George Bush doubled the debt from 5 to $10 trillion. Obama doubled it from $10 to $20 trillion. You know, what's Trump or Clinton going to double it to? Is it going to be $40 trillion? I mean, eventually, as the CBO and independent think tanks have taken a look at these numbers, they're saying, you know, in the less than the next decade, less than 10 years from now, 100% of government revenues are going to go to just entitlements alone. There will be no money for national defense, and there'll be no money to run government itself. And so that's why I think a lot of it is ignorance, John, because obviously, if you ever watch these testimonies, whether the Fed's on Capitol Hill or somebody testifying on a very important economic issue, it's obvious that the Congress people don't understand economics or finances at all. You can just see it. I mean, there's economic illiteracy. You have the same thing in the press, although I think part of the press is just what I call bias, where they don't cover these issues and report them, because I think there would be a different outcome if people were told the truth. And one of the reasons I think Donald Trump is popular is he's just a straight shooter in the way he talks. He's not politically correct. And people have liked that coming from a politician, because most politicians are born liars. I mean, basically what you hear on the stump is hyperbole.
Well, we are going to follow this here on Financial Sense News Hour, because I think what the people are telling us is tell us the truth, even if they don't want the truth. Maybe this is a Jack Nicholson moment, because a lot of what is being promised is simply not in the capacity of government now to provide it. And you're going to see this tension growing. So this is worth monitoring, both from a political standpoint and from an economic and investment standpoint. Well, next week, the Democrats have their convention. We get to settle in, and very much like I did this week, the mute button is your friend quite frequently, because you don't go, okay, I can't deal with this anymore. Click. You hold off for a while. What we've discussed here today, as far as both helicopter money, our rising debt and the next crisis, versus what we called in the second part of the big picture, fiscal fairy tales and fantasies. So we're going to see what happens.
And don't forget, the Fed will be meeting next week. I doubt if they're going to do anything. I still think, John, if they do anything, they're not going to raise interest rates to December. They saw the reaction of raising rates in December last year and what had happened to the markets for 6 weeks of this year. I just don't think there's any way that they're going to go 2 months before the election, raise interest rates of a quarter of a point, because they can't predict what's going to happen. So I don't think anything's going to come out of the Fed next week. I don't think they're going to raise interest rates in September. If there's anything, it's going to be December. In the meantime, we're just trying to get through the second quarter earnings season. Once again, second quarter profits are down for the fifth consecutive quarter in a row. And so we'll get a little bit more of that. And of course, we'll be looking for next week. We'll have the Democratic convention. It'll be interesting to see if that draft proposal, which is out on the web right now, whether they go ahead with some of these things, whether they're adopted, because there are changes made at the convention. There's a little backroom deals. People are negotiating just as they did at the Republican convention. So next week, we'll confirm a lot of the things in the Democratic platform. But then after that, John, it's political blood sport from now to, what is it, November 2nd or November 6th, that we have the election.
And remember, the whole game is to win. That's what people need to understand. This is all rhetoric. It's all to win. And that plays a big role in the middle of it all. But it is blood sport, let's face it. Before we go, we're coming up on our August recess, which we always do here on the program for the last 2 months of the year. Although we are going to have programs for those weeks that we're planning right now. You do a lot of reading during that time, as I do. I actually turn off the news because we deal with it so much here.
Really? You know what happens when we take time off?
Yes,
John.
I know what happens. I was deep in the heart of British Columbia in Canada when the whole market fell apart last year. But it's all right. Anyway, well, what I try to do is I pick up reading of things that I want to read about rather than chasing stuff we do for the show. So what's on your reading list this year?
I just finished The Only Game in Town, which is by Mohammed El Arian. It's about central banks and how if they don't get it right next time, we could be in real trouble. Another book I intend to read is called The End of Financial Alchemy by Mervyn King. He was the former governor of the Bank of England. He's basically saying, you know, central banks are running out of magic tricks. Then I'm also reading something. It's written by Michael Lewitt, a very famous hedge fund manager, and he's author of The Credit Strategist. You remember, John, in 1999, there was that Time magazine cover of Greenspan, Rubin, and Lawrence Summers, and it was called The Committee to Save the World. I'm reading Lewitt's new book called The Committee to Destroy the World, Inside the Plot to Unleash a Super Crash on the Global Economy. and it is highly recommended. And then I'm also going to read a fictional version of what happens when the economy collapses and the dollar collapses. It's called The Mandibles. It's by Lionel Shriver. It's a novel, In God We Trusted, and it's a fictional novel of what happens to this very well-to-do family with the collapse of the dollar and the collapse of the U.S. economy from too much debt. So it's a fictional version of what some are pretending could actually take place if we don't get our act in gear. So those are the four books. Well, I read one of them already, but those are the three I'm going to read next. And of course, the new Daniel De Silva novel called Black Widow. So that's on the summer reading list. Well, in the meantime, on behalf of John Leffler and myself, we are out of time. We'd like to thank you for joining us here on the Financial Sense News Hour. Until you and I talk again, we hope you have a pleasant weekend.
You can subscribe to Financial Sense News Hour in the iTunes and BlackBerry podcast libraries, or at feeds.feedburner.com/FSM. Find more information about our guests at www.financialsense.com/newshour. Friend us at www.facebook.com/financialsenseonline. For our on-the-go listeners, you can access Financial Sense on your mobile device at m.financialsense.com. The Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of James Poplava and do not take into account listeners' suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense News Hour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies profiled on or advertising with Financial Sense, or arising out of the use of any material on the News Hour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.